Hello, and welcome to our series of podcasts for Equine Health Week 2026 in partnership with Agria. If you've been keeping up with our social media feeds today, you'll have seen that the focus has been all about colic, and we've shared various different resources. But ensuring your horse has a healthy digestive system and a diet that meets their needs is just one step in reducing the risk of numerous gastrointestinal problems. So we have reunited our equine nutrition dream team from Dodson and Horrell and NAF to look at some of the feeding fundamentals needed in order to promote well-being in our horses. You've heard from them several times already on this podcast, but I'm delighted to say they are back here today. First up, we have Dr. Margaret Maas, who is Head of Veterinary Equine Health and Performance at Dodson and Horrell. She has been a vet for more than 10 years, with seven of those spent in equine practice, both in the UK and Europe. Her role at D&H involves helping the team and their customers with technical information and product advice, providing marketing support and responding to nutritional management queries. Welcome, Marga.
Thanks, Rachel. Very happy to be back.
And we are delighted to have you. And joining Marga as well is Kate Hoare. She is the head nutritionist at NAF, where she has worked for nearly 28 years. A registered equine nutritionist who's on the British Equestrian Trade Association, ENFAR. She is also a member of the Beta Feed Committee and secretary for the European Workshop on Equine Nutrition Association, and has been widely published on a variety of nutrition topics. Welcome, Kate.
Hello, Rachel. Thank you so much for inviting us back.
It's an absolute pleasure. So in terms of the equine digestive system, what are the key principles we need to keep in mind when we are formulating a diet for our horses? Because obviously their needs are slightly different to ours as people.
I think it's important, first of all, to acknowledge that the digestive system plays a crucial role in the horse's health. And that's not just from the, obviously, the essential part of digesting and absorbing nutrients, but we also must remember that a great part of the horse's immune system lies within the digestive tract. So anything kind of begins with looking after that digestive health. One of the key aspects that we tend to promote in terms of nutritional principles is ensuring that the horse has sufficient and adequate supply of forage. So that begins with the starts us off with the fiber conversation, I guess. We often say that that looks like at least 1.5% of the horse's body weight in daily dry matter forage intake. So that will take into account the moisture percent of the different forage sources. So obviously it's not going to be the same if we talk about fresh grass pasture as if we do preserved forages. But that is a kind of a good starting point in terms of feeding principles. If we think about what we call the three Fs of equine well-being, so these are friends, freedom, and forage, I think it becomes already clear that the forage conversation can't and shouldn't be left behind. And I think that this is where we have to remind ourselves that modern husbandry practices are not always conducive with really optimizing those three Fs. And that we as horse owners, nutritionists, and vets can definitely play a role in advising and feeding according to sound principles when it comes to digestive health.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's important from a fibre and forage point of view. And I think Marga makes a very good point there about the challenges of modern equine management. And I think one of the things I like to think about in terms of practical management, if you're keeping your horse stabled, sometimes that's necessary to have a horse in the stable longer than perhaps nature intended. Think about not only providing that forage and fibre, but trying to replicate natural grazing. The horse is designed to eat and walk. And that walking, if we're thinking about digestive health and the colic risk, that actually becomes really relevant when we restrict their movement. Out in the pasture, horses will naturally walk maybe 6 or 7 miles a day, wild horses much more than that. So if you've got a horse stabled and you think, oh, well, I'm doing everything I can do because I'm feeding him ad lib forage, that's great. But think about maybe something simple like splitting that forage up into opposite sides of the stable and putting the water bucket in another corner again. And that just starts to encourage that natural movement around the box, because movement is part of that gut health as well.
I think that's particularly key at this time of year, obviously, with, you know, a lot of us having very wet fields at the moment. Maybe horses are not getting as much turnout as they might at other points of the year. I think that, as you say, that the way we're feeding the forage in the stable becomes particularly key at the moment. And obviously as well, thinking about the trickle feeding element as well, because obviously we want that forage, that fibre going through their digestive system pretty consistently throughout the day. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. And if you are putting forage out, if you're able to turn out, maybe if you're using a school for turnout while everywhere's so muddy, you know, it's really tempting to pop out a great big hay net and say, there you go, you've got your hay. But maybe think about splitting that up into two or three nets around the school or forage feeders, just to encourage that movement.
Yeah, this is such an important point, because I think as much as obviously we've kind of said what sufficient or adequate forage supply looks like, Kate makes a really, really good point on the distribution over a 24-hour period. I think it can be a common accidental mistake, because I think, you know, if it happens, it's not because, it's rather because it hasn't been thought of properly. But yeah, maybe kind of for loading the day when it comes to forage, and then not thinking about what is the horse going to have access to overnight, whether that's outside in the field or in the stable, it is sometimes a common find, and it can definitely have consequences that we will touch on later when it comes to prolonged fasting periods that we should ideally avoid.
And that's probably quite a key area to move on to, is obviously we've talked about the importance of having this fibre going through the digestive system. Why actually is it so important, Margaret, in terms of maintaining the health of that digestive system?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, fibre is crucial because it increases chewing time, which I'm pretty sure everyone has heard this phrase before. This is important not only from the point of view of encouraging normal feeding behavior and slowing down the rate of ingestion, but it also encourages and supports the normal production of saliva. Now, saliva has naturally a component of bicarbonate, and when the horse swallows this saliva, it will then have a buffering effect to an extent on the acidity of the gastric environment. When we use alfalfa, for example, to that end, from the point of view of increasing chewing time and stimulating saliva production, there is also the added benefit of the calcium content within the alfalfa, which also adds or acts synergistically to the buffering effect of the bicarbonate, which is the main interesting aspect of using alfalfa to bulk out feeds. In terms of trickle feeding and how fiber can help to that end, if we use fiber to bulk out smaller meals of hard feed, it can definitely help from a gastric health perspective. I think we should remember that the horse's stomach has a limited capacity to stretch out in response to a meal and to accommodate the arrival of content. So the larger the meal, actually, the faster the stomach will empty into the small intestine, and this can cause problems further down the line in terms of overwhelming the horse's digestive capacity. So one good principle to remember is limiting meal sizes to 0.4% of the horse's body weight, which is obviously a number that hardly anybody will remember. But if we think about 2 kilos as a standard or as a maximum meal size, rather, for a 500 kilo horse, I think this is probably more approachable. And when we talk in cube volumes, 2 kilos is just about a flat stub scoop. So ideally, you wouldn't want to feed more than that amount in a single meal. But if you can, but that's a limit, not a goal, if that makes sense. So yeah. If we can break it down further and then use fiber to bulk out that volume, fiber will also help kind of slowing that rate of stomach emptying and give more time to the digestive tract to process everything. So that's kind of the more practical aspect. The other point that I would like to touch on is the fact that fiber is actually not digested by enzymes in the horse's digestive tract, but it is actually digested by billions of microorganisms that populate the horse's colon. When that happens, not only fiber gets broken down into short chain fatty acids, which can be used by the horse both to keep warm. So there is a crucial aspect here of supplying enough fiber in the form of forage and other fiber sources to keep the horse warm during the winter. But these microorganisms will also produce significantly important compounds that are beneficial for the horse, from group B vitamins, biotin. These are all critical components to the horse's health, as well as the immune system. And to tie it all together, I'd say this is not about avoiding, you know, hard feeds or bucket feeds, but rather being aware of what goes into them. And I'm sure we'll touch on this later on. But critically, being aware of the starch levels within the diet, because if we overdo it in terms of starch supply, it often comes at the expense of fiber intake, and that can have, as we've discussed, consequences on both overall health as well as specifically digestive health.
Yeah, it's quite a fine balance there, getting, as you say, getting all those levels right to make sure the horse is getting everything they need and not too much of one thing or another. And in terms then of actually choosing the right type of fiber for your horse, because obviously we've talked about some of them. We've got, you know, your grass, your preserved forages, and the chopped ones you might be putting in a feed. What should you take into account, Kate, when you're choosing the right one for your horse and how you feed it, I guess, as well?
Yeah, so I think that's an important point. Just think about what's suitable for your horse in terms of their age, their body condition requirements. Do they need a low energy? Do they need to be getting a bit more energy from their fibres and forages? You know, something like a good alfalfa chaff can actually be, you know, really relatively high in energy and protein, whereas a low energy hay would be much more suitable to a horse requiring a lower energy diet. So think about what their requirements are, particularly if perhaps they've got any compromised dental issues, or, you know, if they're an older horse, make sure that you're getting their dental seen to regularly by an equine dentist or your vet, of course, and they will be able to recognize any challenges there and say whether maybe you need a forage replacer. So all of those will be taken into account when you're choosing a forage. Another thing I think is really important for people is simply availability. You know, sometimes if you're on a yard, that yard may provide hay, they might provide haylage, that might be almost what you're stuck with, you know, that because if you're in that situation, then you want to use that. And also availability from what's being produced locally to you. We saw last year some real challenges in forage production, and where you are in the country will dictate whether you're more likely to have haylage available or hay. So one thing I would say is particularly between those two, maybe don't be too frightened of either one of them. You know, either one of them can be you can look at how you're feeding them to make them appropriate for most horses. And I stress most. Sometimes there's a concern that people think, oh, haylage is too rich. The horse has runny droppings, digestive problems. Maybe they change their behavior on haylage. That's almost never to do with what we would call rich in terms of energy or protein. And it's actually much more to do with the moisture content, which is hugely different to hay. So hay might be 80-90% dry matter. Haylage is more, we are seeing drier haylages produced now, but typically haylage is around about 50% dry matter. So what you should never do is think about feeding them weight for weight. They just are not equivalent weight. You know, if you pick up a 5 kilo net of haylage, 2.5 kilos of that is water. Whereas if you pick up a 5 kilo net of hay, pretty much 5 kilos, 4.5 kilos is hay. So that's really important. If you're changing from one to the other, think about the moisture content, because that's, if you suddenly change the haylage, you've got more moisture going through, you're diluting the gut contents, you're changing what you're offering the microbes, and those microbes that Marga talked about, they're super important, but they're also quite sensitive to change. They don't like change. And we talk about the golden rules of feeding, and one of those golden rules is make changes gradually. And we as horse owners, we're pretty good with that, with what goes in the bucket. But I think we can be guilty of forgetting the same applies to the forage. And the forage, as Marga said, is the largest part of the diet. So if you're changing that forage, do it gradually. Even if you're changing from one bale to the next bale of the same type of forage, ideally you want to mix a little bit in towards the end of the bale and the start of the new one. So you try and minimize those changes. And then if you have got particular requirements, if you've got perhaps an older horse with dental issues, then you can be looking at forage replacers like grass nuts and short chop and such like. So putting more into the bucket in terms of a nice bucket full of short chop fibres and forages, maybe soaked, which softens the fibres and again helps those with dental issues. Okay, but generally, certainly for most horses, hay or haylage at this time of year, and when you don't have access to grass, I would say either one of them is suitable for most horses, but you may just have to look at how you manage them and think about, what they bring to the diet, basically.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, and one that I think many of us will actually be going through at the moment. It's certainly the case on my yard. We normally have hay for all the horses. There's been a shortage, which is harder to get hold of, so we're starting to bring some haylage in and having to do that transferring over process at the moment. And I have to say, from a horse that has never touched a haylage in her life, thank goodness mine is actually eating it at the moment, which is a great relief. But yeah, it is, I think that's a very important topic to discuss there, and the fact that haylage and hay are much more user-friendly, particularly the haylage, because I know a lot of people get quite concerned about feeding it to their horses.
Most horses find it, good haylage, very palatable.
Yeah, mine's just a bit of a weirdo. That's to say, it's kind of working at the moment, so we're rolling with it. But I think possibly, again, because we're talking about more of a wrapped hay in terms of moisture content than a haylage, so it is less wet, as we talk about.
Can I just make a comment as well, which I think in light of the concerns this winter over the forage shortage in particular, obviously we've touched on the potential transitions between hay and haylage, which Kate has really outlined really well. I think I would like just to make a point about considering straw, quality cereal straw, as a forage option. I think in the UK, we do have a significant population of leisure horses that might actually tend to be generally good doers. So there is, no need to rely or to seek out high nutritional value forages in terms of supporting them to maintain or gain weight. And actually, good quality cereal straw can be a feasible partial contribution to their daily forage intake. So we do have now research that shows that is a very safe option. Obviously, straw is a much lower nutritional value forage compared to hay or haylage, but it can achieve the goal of really feeding those colon microbes and those gut microbes and enabling them to produce those essential nutrients and energy, whilst not contributing to sugar intake. And you can actually effectively replace up to a third, 40% at the push, of the total forage intake of hay or haylage with quality oat or barley straw. And obviously the introduction has to be phased. We tend to recommend incrementally introducing it every 3 to 4 days, adding a little bit more until you reach that third rate of replacement. But it can be a very successful and interesting option if a horse owner has a good doer, and especially in the context of this year's shortage.
Yeah, no, very good point. As you say, many of us are dealing with horses who get fat, but just by looking at the grass. So that straw can be a really useful addition to the diet to help manage the calorie intake while still making sure that you're getting lots of fibre going through the digestive system. So no, very good point. Thank you, Marga. We sort of touched a little bit already on bucket feeds, but I think that's another important component of the diet. Most horses these days are having a bucket feed of some description. So I think it's worth us touching on that and some of the considerations to make sure what you're giving your horse is suitable for him and his set of circumstances.
Yes, definitely. I think in line with what I've been discussing, we tend to recommend prioritizing forage as the core source of energy, so ensuring that the minimum supply. And then I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the goal that we seek to accomplish with our bucket feed? So essentially, it comes down to supplying additional energy and or nutrients that we just simply don't cover just with forage alone. So when it comes to choosing a bucket feed, one big clue will be already provided to us by the manufacturer. So the feed will come with a typical indication for use. So that's what type of horse this feed has been formulated for. And this is usually based on the horse's age and physiological stage, as well as the workload level. So on this point, very important, and I believe we touched on this last year, to feed for the work that the horse has done, not for the work that we think or we would like them to do, because we all know how weeks go and how, you know, life just happens. So, definitely being honest about how much work our horse is doing and how much we should then put in the tank to fuel that work. There are resources online that can help define, you know, what we tend to consider maintenance, which is basically no work or just you know, paddock and box rest. And then there is generally three categories of light, medium, and hard work. So there are resources, as I say, online, which are pretty handy. The next step would be to be aware, I would say, of what role ingredients play within a feed formula. And in line with those principles of prioritizing fiber, looking for ingredients that are fiber rich, so such as your chopped fibers, so that could be alfalfa, oat straw, grass straw, etc., as well as the super fibers or the fermentable fibers, so you typically your beet pulp, your soya hulls, your oat husks. These super fibers are actually very interesting. I was just going to say super interesting super fibers. But they are definitely very useful ingredients when we are trying to increase the energy density of the horse's intake without using cereals, which we will touch on in a second. But these super fibers, they do provide energy in a more slow release fashion, but more consistently with promoting gastric health. So finding those ingredients higher up or early on in the ingredients list is already a good clue that this bucket feed is going to contribute as well to the overall daily fiber intake. Now, often we have to add cereals to bucket feeds, especially when we formulate them for horses in medium to hard work. So this is not about cereals or starch being a friend or a foe, but it's about how we use them and how we incorporate them. So generally speaking, cereals that have been treated either by temperature or mechanically, so broken down, cooked, etc., they will have a better digestibility profile than the ones that are incorporated whole or untreated within a formula. This is important because when we use treated cereals that are more digestible, we are giving a better chance to the horse's digestive system to process them and absorb them at the site where this is meant to happen, which is the foregut, so just after the stomach. If we oversupply cereals, even when they are treated, and the horse has a limited capacity to digest the starch within the cereals, so if we overdo it, part of this cereal or part of this undigested starch will then reach the hindgut, so the end part of the digestive system, which is not prepared to process or absorb starch. What will then happen is that this undigested starch will then begin to ferment within the horse's colon, and it will create an acidic environment. Starch ferments into a lactic acid, which has then an effect on the microbes and on the microorganisms that live in the colon, and they can become less effective at fermenting fiber. So it's kind of a bit of a domino effect of consequences. And in line with that and that limited capacity to digest starch, we tend to advise not feeding more than 1 gram of starch per kilo of body weight per feed. Now, that's a lot of information, but in practical terms, that means if your horse weighs 500 kilos, don't feed more than 500 grams of starch in a single feed. Now, and then the same would be if your horse weighs 300 kilos, then that would be 300 grams per feed. This can be a bit complicated maths to work around, but if you look at the back of pack and there is a starch declaration, which is not always there, but if you call the manufacturer, they would be very happy to provide that information for you. And then you can break down how much you feed in every single meal and then work out how much that starch percent equals to. And we do that in order to ensure that we do not overwhelm that starch digestive capacity. I think finally, and again going back to the kind of the standard or the average horse owner that has a horse that works to what will qualify as a light to medium work level every week. In most cases, a good combination of quality forage plus a bucket feed that is high in fiber, so that could be either a chopped fiber, a combination of, or looking for feed that have the higher fiber proportion plus a balancer, is really just going to be perfectly fine and just ensure that the overall nutrient quality of the diet is optimized without risking having to do all of these calculations for starch, which we do always do when it comes to performance horses, because we do use higher cereal incorporations in the diet, but we always want to do it in a safe way.
Absolutely. And yeah, as you say, I think it's a case of looking at the back of that packet, and the manufacturers will have given you plenty of information there about how to feed the products, what's actually in them. And as you say, Margaret, if you've got any concerns about that or you want further advice, the majority of them will have a helpline or a feed line or a nutrition line or whatever they term it as, where you can speak to someone there who can help you work out how best to use that feed within your horse's diet. Now we've talked there, we've got our perfect bucket feed, which is doing the job for the majority of the horses out there. But I guess, Kate, there are going to be some horses who might need a bit of extra support for their gut, whether it's because of age or a medical condition or something like that. What's the best way to make sure they're getting that support through the feed?
Yeah, that's right, Rachel. I think it's really important. We've talked a lot about the fiber element of the diet and the forage and the microbes, particularly that microbial population in the hindgut that breaks down the diet. And we've mentioned how sensitive they are, and they don't particularly like change, and they don't, so it is really important to keep that population as balanced as you possibly can. And it may be, as you say, an older horse or a horse with some immunity challenges, because the gut is about 70% of immunity. So any health condition will impact. But also it can just be a horse who's traveling regularly, who's competing regularly, or who's working at a medium to hard level, or who having to spend time stabled. All of these things can challenge that hindgut microbiome. So there are supplements we can use that help to maintain the microbiome, prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics now as well. Probiotics are perhaps the best known. The probiotics are the live microbes. They're called live fed microbials. It's almost like sending down more to help repopulate the hindgut. In the horse world, there's only one legal live probiotic, and that is a yeast. You'll see it written on the back of the label, whether it's a bag or a pot. It'll be under the additives section. And it'll importantly look for the CFU number. CFU stands for colony forming unit. And that shows you that it is the live probiotic. If there's no CFU, it's not a probiotic. If it says live bacteria, that's not a legal probiotic for horses. So look just for that live yeast, Saccharomyces. That's your probiotic, helping to repopulate essentially the hindgut. And then we've got prebiotics, and sort of the next step on from what Marga was talking about, sometimes those prebiotics stray into the super fiber, but more so soluble fibers can get into the prebiotics, things like chicory, inulin and such like. But you'll also see MOS and FOS. MOS and FOS are mannan oligosaccharide and fructo oligosaccharide. They're both a bit of a mouthful, and that's why we tend to call them MOS and FOS. But effectively, they are specialized sugars. And don't be worried about the word sugar. They're specialized sugars that are there to feed the probiotics, to feed the hindgut in there. So the best way I ever had it described to me was, if you feed probiotics, it's like sending the soldiers down. If you feed probiotics and prebiotics, it's sending the soldiers with their lunchbox. So that's the best way to think about it. And in recent years, we're now looking at postbiotics as well. And postbiotics are an interesting new category. They're actually the end products of fermentation. So they're what that bacteria end up with. Marga touched on them earlier in terms of things like the B vitamins and some of those breakdown metabolites of fermentation. They are postbiotics. And so now we're looking at what we call tribiotics, which are pre, pro and post altogether. And additionally, you can, particularly for some of these loose droppings and changes that we see with digestive upset, it can be really useful to pop those in with digestive absorbents as well. So digestive absorbents would be things like bentonite clay. Again, that will be on the back of the pot. Under the additive section, it says sodium bentonite or something like that. And that's like feeding a sponge. It just goes down, mops up all the excesses and helps to stabilize that very sort of wet hindgut reaction. Also, things like psyllium husk have a similar soluble fiber mopping up excesses. So, yes, there are things we can do to keep the microbes happy and to keep them doing their job. But, you know, no matter what the modern equine lifestyle throws at them, really.
And I think obviously, again, with all these supplements and things, it's looking, making sure that you're buying them from a reputable seller and looking for that NOPS label as well. We've talked about NOPS plenty in the past, but again, it applies here as well.
It absolutely does. And I think a quick add on to that, as well as NOPS, Beta have recently launched the NFAR scheme. NFAR is the feed advisor register with Beta. There are two separate sections. There's feed advisors, you may find them in store or with some of the feed companies. And there's nutritionists as well, which again, most of the reputable feed and supplement companies will have Beta NFAR nutritionists now, or Beta NFAR feed advisors. So look for those as well to give you some really reputable advice.
So we've talked about we're going to say the dry elements of what your horse is eating there, but actually You want some fluids going in there as well, particularly as a lot of this forage and things we talked about are very dry. They need some help maybe getting through the system. So let's talk about hydration. Why is it important to ensure our horses are drinking enough, and how should we be doing that?
Well, that's absolutely right, Rachel. So water is often described as the most important nutrient that no one ever mentions. But it is, in many ways, it is the most important nutrient. It's super natural to the diet. And the spring grass that will be coming through, hopefully shortly, is very high in moisture. I mentioned earlier that hay might be 90% dry matter. By contrast, spring grass can be 90% water. So it's absolutely the other end of the scale. And as it goes on through the summer, that will drop a little bit, but it's still, grass is always very high in moisture, as is any live living plant. And that's what the horse evolved to eat. You know, they're browsers, they eat grasses, trees, shrubs, herbs and such like. They're all high in moisture. And the challenge that has for particularly the stable kept horse is that it means naturally the horse does not have a high first response. That because naturally most of their, all of their water requirements come from fresh grazing, they don't think, oh, I need a drink. So actually we have to encourage them to drink. One of the easiest ways to do that can be with soaking hay, adding water to your bucket feed, you know, those nice fiber feeds we talked about earlier. If you add water to those, that a really useful way to help them take in water. Things like soaked beet and such like, again, a useful way to take in water. And also remember to make sure they're getting some salt. So if they've been working hard or working to any extent or traveling, they need electrolytes in their diet. But even if they're just at light level and maintenance, hanging up a salt lick, giving them free salt. Sodium salt is the one nutrient that horses will self-select. They don't self-select most nutrients, but like any grazing animal, they will self-select sodium. So give them free access to a salt lick in the field and stable, and that can help them to encourage them to take. Just like, you don't see it so often these days, but I'm old enough to remember pubs that put out bowls of peanuts on the counter. And that wasn't because they were being generous, Rachel. It was because those peanuts had salt on them. And that made us drink more when we're in the pub. And the salt has the same effect with our horses. So making sure they've got some of that in their diet. And the other thing, you know, hopefully we're coming out of winter now and some warmer weather. But over winter, and if we do get a cold snap, think about keeping their stable water a little bit warm if you can. We're not talking about boiling cups of tea for horses, but maybe just lagging the bucket with an old rug. I used to put old rugs around my horse's bucket, or banking up some of the straw around the bucket. And that's because there is research that shows horses don't particularly like very cold water. So unlike us, you know, if we've been out, gone for a jog or something, which I very rarely do, but if we've been out, we're the first to reach into the fridge for a nice cold drink, but horses don't. And if you can keep the water a little bit tepid, again, that just encourages them to take in a bit more.
Very good point, Ms. Simpson, particularly at this time of year. I know for a fact my horse is quite fussy about the temperature of her water, so she gets quite a bit of sugar beet to make sure she's getting the moisture in when she decides either very hot or very cold. She doesn't like drinking. Yeah. So
there is a very good reason why we have a saying in this country that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. You absolutely can't. So water in feed is often the best approach.
So we've talked a lot here about sort of the general principles of good nutrition, what we should be doing to help keep that gut nice and healthy. But to bring us back to the theme of what other things we've been discussing today, which is colic, Margaret, with your vet hat on, as you know, let's make full use of you here. With your vet hat on, why is applying all the things we've talked about today and keeping that gut really healthy important in terms of reducing the risk of colic?
Yes, definitely. I think it's going to be a bit of a, you know, a closing question, this one, because it's just repeating many of the aspects that we've already touched on. Kate made a really good point when she was talking about forage, about the potential repercussions of sudden changes and in general, any disruption to the horse's diet. This is because the equine digestive system is very complex, not only in structure, but also in function. That means that there are many, many aspects that can and sadly often do go wrong. So as we have explained, really supporting the integrity of the equine gut microbiome is crucial. So we've already explained how many of the feeding principles that we have touched on have a good positive impact on that. And then if I was to add a few more tips from a veterinary and healthcare perspective, the first one would be to remember to monitor your horse's oral and dental health regularly. This is important at every age, but especially when horses, you know, become a little bit older. So from, you know, from their teenage years onwards, or if they have had, you know, a past history of dental fractures or any other issues that have had veterinary or specialist work done. So these horses can have a higher risk of choke just because they might not be able to chew forage and other feedstuffs as well as other horses. So as long as we know, we can tailor their diet and we can just make sure that their nutrition is optimized and that their forage intake is actually met through forage types that they can actually chew and thrive on. And this is where Kate has already mentioned, partial or total forage replacement diets can be very, very handy because there are cases in which, you know, horses are losing weight significantly and it's just through not being able to chew properly and therefore get the most goodness out of the diets. Then it's about remembering those core feeding principles. So your meal sizes, keeping them under 2 kilos for a 2 kilos per feed for a 500 kilo horse, 1 kilo per feed for a 250 kilo pony, for instance, and being aware of the proportion of starch so as not to overwhelm that starch digestion capacity. Specifically when it comes to gastric ulcers, which sadly can be a common cause, especially of recurrent or repetitive colic episodes, the key nutritional risk factors would be sudden changes to the diet, either bucket feed or forage or both, as well as consistently feeding very large meals, which again we've touched on, with a high level of starch intake. So I know it's very repetitive, but these are really the core feeding principles. And then when it comes to what we call spasmodic or gas colic, I would strongly encourage to have a multidisciplinary approach between the vet and a qualified ENFA registered, if possible, nutritionist to try and work out what the best diet can be for that horse. Because it's true that can sometimes be caused by lack of fiber, because fiber ensures that the motility levels are adequate and actually that the gas can be pushed out of the digestive system. Sometimes it's about the type and proportions of fibers. So certain horses might not be able to tolerate at certain times long stem fibers and might need their forage supply to come from chopped fibers and maybe hay cubes and other forms of forage, but these are certainly cases where a combined approach between a vet and a nutritionist can be very, very beneficial.
Thank you. There's some really good points. I think one probably to pick up on, we talk about making slow changes to a diet. How slow are we talking? Like, what sort of time period should we be making those changes over?
Yeah, so for bucket feeds, we tend to recommend at least a week, generally 10 to 12 days, because then you can replace a proportion that is 20 to 25% of the existing bucket feed in each meal. And then you increase that every 3 to 4 days. So you do three or four days at 25% of each bucket feed being the new feed, and then 50-50, and then three quarters, one quarter. But as Kate mentioned, when it comes to changing forage, we should really allow them more time. So, you know, 2 weeks, at least 2 to 3 weeks, where you again do a phased replacement. So ideally not wait until you have completely run your hay or haylage supplies to the ground and you're ready to open a new batch and then start straight, but rather, you know, maybe forecast your supply and your demand a little bit more so that you can overlap the old and the new for a period of time.
Yeah. And I think as we start thinking about turning our horses out more as well, just carry on feeding that forage in the field if you can for at least for a short period of time, because that fresh spring grass is very, very different to anything they've been eating over winter. So if we can still give them some hay, that gives them some continuity as they start to take in that spring grass as well.
Yeah, very good point there. And I think we're all desperately thinking of spring. Yeah. But yes, as you say, it does also bear thinking about in terms of the introduction of that new grass into the diet and considering that a change just as much as anything else. As we kind of wrap up towards the end here, do either of you have any kind of key takeaway messages or resources that would be good for people to look at? Any parting messages?
I think there are quite a lot of resources out there. Most feed companies, feed and feed supplement companies, as you say, they'll have an advice line. You know, do use that. And particularly look out, mentioned it briefly earlier, the new Beta NFAR scheme. You know, part of what allows you to register on that scheme is showing that you're giving credible advice, and you're not just, you know, we're not just there trying to flog our products. We're actually giving good all round advice. That's really important to that scheme. So look for someone who's accredited to that, and they should be able to give you, you know, a decent steer, really. And also a lot of these companies now have informative sort of blogs and additional information on their website, so that can be a useful area to look at as well.
Yes, definitely. I would second that, and I would also recommend everyone to check out the new Canter guidelines. So these are the new worm awareness and worm control resistance that have been issued recently. They are available both online on Canter UK, and there is also a very handy, useful app, which I think can hopefully help us get a grip of the rising problem of worm resistance in this country, and just use better, more targeted and tailored worming practices.
Absolutely, very good point. And if you are interested in worming or anything similar to that, we have recently done a series of podcasts on it, so go back to wherever it is that you found this one. There are 3 episodes there, all dedicated to testing for parasites, management, the environmental impact, and those Canter guidelines that Margaret has mentioned there are mentioned many times in there. And you will also find the links as well to find the guidelines in the descriptions for those podcasts, so do check them out, because as Margaret says, they are a very, very useful resource. Thank you both very, very much for your time today. It's been another, hopefully for everyone listening at home, really interesting insight into the world of nutrition. I know it's something that I'm really interested in, and I always do really enjoy our chats.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting us, Rachel.
Thanks, everyone.
And thank you to everyone listening at home. If this has whet your appetite for more nutrition stuff, as I say, you can find more from Kate and Margaret in our back catalogue. We have previously discussed nutrition for your horse throughout their lifetime. And we've also done an episode all about clean sport and NOPS as well. So they are both really good listens, and I recommend you check them out. I hope you've been following along with Equine Health Week this week. We've shared loads of really, really interesting stuff on a range of topics. Obviously, there's been lots of colic stuff related today, but there's been plenty more shared, and we've got some more stuff coming up. Make sure you listen to the podcast episodes relating to those as well. And hopefully you will be joining us again very soon. Thank you for listening.